following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Hi. Okay, are we back on the air, Jack? Yes, okay. We were lost in those sounds. This is Bernie Wise.
And Carol Butler.
Back on the air with another show about Belize, because there was so much going on there and so many things to talk about that I'm going to do this one more last show. And if you don't know it, those were whale sounds.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yes, that we couldn't fit in the first show, so Jack put it on now. And they are humpback whales. And years ago... I think Judy Collins, or one of the folk singers, put out a record of singing along with the whales. And those sounds were taken underwater. And a lot of them are very low frequency ones. You heard the rumbling one. Mm-hmm. And those can travel halfway around the earth. So the whales can communicate with each other long distances.
And how did you, the young man who was on the trip with you had a hydrophone,
Eric.
So he was recording the sounds of the dolphins. How
yes.
did you hear the dolphin sounds?
Okay,
are they different?
Okay, he had his hydrophone on the boat, which is basically an underwater microphone.
Right.
And the dolphins click.
Right.
We heard the clicks.
Right.
And then in the evening, he was trying to get them so we could hear the audio, but it didn't work out. But he showed us a printout of the sounds, like you would, if you went for a hearing test, they would, they would have a chart showing the frequencies of your sound. So he had a graph showing the frequencies of the sounds.
Because they make whistling sounds.
They make whistling sounds,
but I don't know
too.
How it compares to the humpback whale.
I think they're much higher.
Higher, I would imagine, because they're so
they
much
sound
smaller.
Like squeaking and stuff like that. Yeah, they're smaller. The whales have these great resonator bodies where they can produce, like a bass. You know, and the operator, you know, these really low sounds. Even though some of those sounds we just heard are higher, but that was the relatives of the dolphins, right? They're big cousins, big cousins. Okay, so let's go back to Belize, which was a great place to visit. And I know Carol has her bags packed already.
I'm very
she's
inspired.
Ready to go. But you'd rather go to Trinidad.
Well, there's a trip coming up to Trinidad New York Audubon is sponsoring in April. And I'm on the fence about it. But this I'm very inspired. I have to go look for my snorkel mask.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to talk about other things from Belize. And but the other show, last week's show, I gave Jack a whole bunch of pictures to put on the site, and look at the pictures if you get a chance, and it'll make it clear in some cases what I'm talking about, because some of it is a little hard to describe, but I'll try my best. Since this is audio radio, if you grew up like I did with just listening to the radio at night when my parents were sleeping, I would put the radio on and listen to radio at night. And during the way, they had to use your imagination.
Right.
Like when the Lone Ranger was on the radio, you had to imagine the sounds. And
I used to listen to Gene Shepard.
I used to listen to him at night.
I love Gene Shepard.
He was terrific.
Yeah.
He was a great talker. My inspiration for radio stuff is Gene Shepard. So, okay, so let's get back to Belize. As I said on the other show on Belize, the other two, we were on this atoll, a Turnof Atoll, which is made up of a bunch of small islands separated by little lagoons. And the one we were on was Blackbird Key. And it was called Blackbird Key because if you looked at the other show, you saw a picture of that beautiful grackle, which is a blackbird. And they were all over the island, whistling and making the noises. But the main important plant on all of these islands is the red mangrove tree. Now, when I worked in the Everglades, I worked in the Western Everglades, and that's called the 10,000 Islands, because this part of the Everglades are all mangrove islands, and they all look exactly the same. So if you were trying to navigate through there, you would need some. You today you a GPS.
Now you didn't have GPS.
Yeah, when
right.
I worked there, you had a compass.
Right.
And they had markers because there was a canoe trail that went for 100 miles from where I worked in the Everglades City, which is on the west coast right near Naples, all the way down to Flamingo, which is in Florida Bay at the southern tip of Florida. So there was this canoe trail that went for 100 miles, and it would take you a week if you canoed the whole thing, at least a week. You could do it in a canoe or a small boat with a small outboard.
I did it. I canoed in mangrove swamps with my son Adam.
Do you remember where it was?
I'm trying to remember where we left, where we departed from.
Did you rent canoes?
Yes.
Yes. And was it in Everglades City, this small, funny little town?
I think it was. I don't remember where it was. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. But I remember it was great.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, we didn't go that far in because
Did you go for the day or overnight? You camped on the island?
No, I didn't. We didn't camp.
Oh,
we just
went
in that
day.
Area and went on a day trip.
I know where you went. Okay. There are some lakes and ponds. When you go down that one road to Flamingo, you went down that road probably. Well, it's a long time ago. But anyway. But we're going to have a show on the Everglades because one of my colleagues from the museum, Ariana, she just came back from the Everglades camping
great.
Out, and I told her where to go and what to do.
Great.
So she's going to put together a show on the Everglades.
Wonderful.
Which is a great place to visit. If you ever want to go and you need information, send me an email, and I'll help you out because I worked down there for a year, and it was a great place. Okay, back to Belize, which is south of Florida.
We're talking about mangroves, so it's all related.
So the red mangroves and his...
Are they red mangroves in the Everglades as well?
Okay. Same ecosystem. Okay. Red mangroves, white mangroves, black mangroves, and another tree called the buttonwood.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why they're important, and I'll tell you just the sequence of these trees. The red mangrove tree is the one that grows in salt water.
So
if you see an island in the tropics with trees in the water, with roots in the water, it's the red mangrove tree.
Okay. Easy enough.
Then if you went further up onto the island, a little bit out of the water, you'd see the black mangrove.
Mm.
Because that one is salt tolerant. It's not as good as the red mangrove.
Right.
And then a little higher up in elevation would be the white mangrove, which thrives in fresh water as well as salt water. And the last one is the buttonwood, which is on dry land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the same family, even though it doesn't do what the other trees do.
Right.
And the reason it's called the buttonwood, because in the old days of high button shoes, they used to make the buttons from the buttonwood tree, which were little round, very hard seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Small, about them, maybe...
Size
of a button.
Right.
And they use those for high button
shoes.
Very
nice.
Okay, let's get back to the to the red mangroves.
That's all right. The digressions are fine.
Yes. We thrive on digressions.
That's right.
That would be a good motto to put up.
Right. The naturalist. We thrive on digressions.
Yeah. Okay. So here are the red mangrove trees. They produce the islands, and here's how they make the islands, and here's how they do it. Okay. They are a pioneer species.
Okay.
When you can't name any other tree that you know of that grows in salt water.
I certainly can't.
Every other tree grows in, could be brackish water, which is very low salt, or fresh water, okay? But the red mangrove has evolved to thrive in salt water. Now, that's a great strategy for survival because it's the only tree that can do it.
Right.
It has no competition.
It has no competition.
Right.
It owns that ecosystem.
That's right. So the red mangroves grow on the edges or the fringes of islands that have become islands thanks to the red mangrove trees. And here's how they do it. Okay. The first thing that I put up pictures of the sequence of how a red mangrove tree reproduces. Now, if you thought you knew everything about sex, well, you don't. Because most trees have flowers, right?
Mm-hmm.
The red mangrove tree has a flower. And they're pollinated by insects, right? As we know, butterflies are major pollinators, and bees, and some ants, and some are pollinated by the wind.
Right.
And some flowers are even self-pollinated.
Some are water-pollinated.
Water-pollinated, right. There are grasses that grow underwater that are pollinated by the water. Okay. So the red mangrove trees are pollinated just like any other tree. Okay, now here's how the difference starts. After a tree, the flower is pollinated.
Are they pollinated by insects?
By insects.
Okay.
Yeah. What happens next after the flower is pollinated.
Normally, the insect carries the pollen to another flower. Right.
And then what happens?
And then the sexual cells join.
Right.
I'm picturing the diagram in my head. I'm trying to think how to explain it.
Yeah. Okay.
But the male cell sort of tunnels into the ovarian cell, and they fuse.
They fuse, and then what grows from that?
A seed. Right.
Okay. Now here's where the difference comes in. Okay. The regular tree, it's a flower, and then you get a seed.
Mm-hmm.
And those seeds turn into fruits.
Right.
Like apple trees. Right. That's what happens in apple trees. The apple flower gets pollinated, and the ovary grows.
Right.
And it produces seeds.
Right.
But to protect the seeds and give it nourishment until it could start a new tree, an apple grows around
it.
Okay.
Right.
The red mango tree doesn't do that. If you look at the pictures I put up there, you see the flower with what looks like a nut growing out of the plant. But in the next picture, you'll see that there's something that's pencil-shaped that's growing down out of this nut of the red mangrove. Okay? Now, that's a seedling.
Right.
That's a future tree. There's no fruit.
Okay? It goes right from seed to a sprout.
Yeah. So it's a seedling.
Right.
So if you looked at the red mangrove tree like on the photograph I showed, it shows this pencil-like thing growing out of the bottom of this nut-like, or maybe you could even call it a fruit.
I'm picturing a bean sprout.
Like a bean sprout.
Okay.
That's perfect. Okay. And they're called propagules because they propagate.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is they'll grow to be 8 inches long, 9 inches long, 10 inches long. Depends on this, you know, the conditions. Okay, so here we have this thing hanging down from the tree. Okay, now, if we want to start a new tree, okay, what happens is this pencil shoot will, when it's ripe, it falls off the tree. And remember, the mangroves are growing over the water.
Right.
So the pencil shoot, or propagule, falls onto the water horizontally because it has two ends. One end, and now you'll like these terms, one end is hydrophilic.
Yes.
And one end is hydrophallic.
Okay.
So we know that hydrophilic means water loving.
Right.
And hydrophallic means afraid of water.
Right.
Right? So this little seedling, a future tree, floats on the water with these two different ends to it. And it could be viable for over a year. And what it does, it floats around until it finds a suitable substrate, like a sandy bottom that has a lot of sediment on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If it comes to that point and it turns vertically. So the hydrophallic one points up.
Right.
And the hydrophilic one starts to absorb water.
So what makes it turn? Why is it?
It turns because it gets waterlogged at one end.
Okay.
It starts absorbing water.
Right.
So it'll stand vertical in the water and it'll take root.
That's probably what it probably floats around vertically for a while, right?
First, it's horizontally.
But then it must float vertically until it comes in contact with a suitable substrate.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And it could do that for a year.
Yeah.
It could be
interesting.
Interesting, yeah. So, anyhow, so here it settles down and it starts a new tree.
Yeah. Great.
Okay. And what happens to the mangrove tree is, as well as putting out these new seedlings, the tree itself sends out roots.
Yes.
Above the water.
Right.
They're called prop roots. It looks like, as Eugene Kaplan said in his book, I forgot to bring it. He says just like the Hindu goddess Shiva, with its arms reaching out to the world,
that's right.
The tree does the same thing. So it gives out these roots that are called prop roots, and those roots take root in the sand. Okay. Not only that, but it also sends out aerial roots,
right,
which don't go in the water, but which make walking through a forest of red mangrove trees almost impossible.
Right.
Okay? So here, picture this one little tree that just started.
Mm.
It's right off the shore. It will start sending out roots and shoots, and when it's mature after a year or two, it starts producing new seedlings.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, these roots that have developed in the water start capturing sediment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it captures enough sediment to start a new island.
Hmm.
And that's how the mangrove islands are made.
Interesting.
Okay, and at the same time that it's doing this, it's producing these tangle of prop roots that are in the water and under the water, picture a whole line of these mangrove trees along the coastline. And they interact with each other by making this tangle of roots.
Right, it's true.
And another interesting thing about the tree, it's an evergreen deciduous tree. Now, that sounds like a conflicting of two terms, because evergreen means it has leaves all the time, and deciduous means it loses its leaves. The red mangrove does both.
Interesting. Okay? Yeah.
So if you see a red mangrove tree growing, you'll see that it has yellow leaves that are dead leaves and green leaves. Mm. Because as it as the year goes by, it produces more and more green leaves and sloughs off the old leaves, the yellow leaves, which fall into the water, and bacteria in the water start to decay it to return the nutrients back to the water column. Yeah. So most of these leaves get caught in the roots. So you have this whole system underneath the roots that's accumulating sediment from all the other mangrove trees and from other dead critters and other plants that live on the island that die also. So this becomes a nursery ground for almost all the fish that we saw on the reef. Right. And that's why I stressed on the last program how important the red mangrove trees are. Because if you picture going from an island out to sea or away from the island, first is the red mangrove trees. Now, what do? They filter the water.
Right.
Okay. They also are a nursery ground for the fish. You go seaward a little bit from there, out away from the shore, you have sand. Okay?
Right.
And what grows in the sand? You get the seagrasses. The seagrasses filter out more and are more protection for fish. And by the time you get to the reef, the water should be clear because it's been filtered by all these things. And the baby fish, when they're old enough, they go out to the reef and spend their lives on the reef. So that's why I dwelt so much on the red mangrove trees. And I have these great pictures of the seedlings and everything and a new island being formed.
Great.
So that's just the red mangrove tree. The other mangrove trees also help to build the islands, but they're not that as important as the red mangrove. And what developers do when they want to make a beach in Florida, they cut down all the mangrove trees because they want to have a sandy beach.
Right.
And that's not a great thing to do. Now, but Florida, for the first 100 years in Florida, they were cutting down all the mangrove trees because everybody wanted to live on the shoreline. What Florida's doing now is they're replanting them because they hold the sand, they keep the, and they're very, very resistant to hurricanes because they grow so thickly that it's very hard. They cut down on the velocity of the wind.
They must,
And remember Louisiana, where they always have flooding in the marshes? Well, if they had left their mangrove trees there, it would have cut down the velocity of the winds.
Sure.
So Florida's has smartened up, you might say, and they are leaving the mangrove trees wherever they're left. There aren't a lot left, but they're replanting them. Because years ago when I was working in Florida, I went to a small park in Port Everglades, which is near it's near that north of Miami. There's where all the cruise ships leave from. They were replanting more along the shoreline. So that's the story about the red mangrove trees. And just another word or two about it. When Columbus came to the New World, and he had a doctor, I think, on board.
Yes.
Or somebody who kept a log. And what he said about the red mangrove trees, when they tried to go on land to get fresh water, he said that thickets were so thick that even a rabbit couldn't get through to show you how thick they are.
Right.
And I've walked on some of those islands, and they're beautiful.
Right. I'm remembering, too, being in those mangrove swamps.
To get through those mangroves.
How tangled they are.
They are tangled.
I hear some wonderful music. I think we're going to take a little break.
We're going to leave the red mangrove trees for now, and there's much more to come about Belize on the second half of the show.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Thursday at 1 p.m., Heather Hyman and Aaron Fairbanks explore the real roles in building a strong community and sustainable farm system. They get nitty-gritty with the people producing our food. They explore distribution networks, dissect policy issues, and converse with some of the nation's most important agents for change to examine current events in the world of agriculture and food. Join them every Thursday live at 1 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network, where all is grist for the mill.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides and
Carol Butler. Back we are on the, back.
Back on the air for part two of the last Belize show of the season. And I spent a lot of time with red mangrove trees. They're really interesting.
Well, they're very interesting. That was very nice.
And emphasize how important they are in that ecosystem. So now I'm going to talk about some other stuff that we saw in Belize. And they were interesting things also. So I'm going to talk about another tree now. This is another interesting tree. And I think it's a West Indian transplant, this tree. I don't know if it was originally native to the New World. I was never able to check that down. But it's called the Gumbo Limbo tree.
Okay.
Okay? And that's the West Indian name for the tree.
I was going to say that's a good name, right?
Yes. So I'm not clear whether it's indigenous or an exotic. But I'll have to find that out. Anyhow, that's a very interesting tree. And you see it growing in Florida and all kinds of tropical places. And it has another name to it that's sort of a common name. It's called the tourist tree.
Okay.
Okay, so why do they call it the tourist tree? Well, it's called the tourist tree because if you look at the picture of the Gumbo Limbo tree on the site that I put a picture on, you see that the bark, you know the birch tree, how the bark peels back
yes.
on it?
Okay. Yes, yeah.
The Gumbo Limbo tree has a paper-thin bark that peels back. And it's red.
Uh-huh.
The trunk is red, and it peels back, and it's red. It looks like somebody had too much sunburn.
Oh, that's funny.
And the skin is peeling.
That's a good name, yeah.
That's what it looks like.
That's great.
Okay? The picture I put on is an extreme example of it. Mm. You'd be in trouble if you peeled this much. But that's what it's called on the islands. It's called the tourist tree.
That's funny.
So we all, you know, peel. And the other name of the tree tells you why, what it's used for. It's called the birdkill tree. And in West Africa, so the name Gumbo Limbo is a West African name for the tree. It's called the birdkill tree because it has a very sticky sap.
Mm-hmm.
And what the folks in Africa used to do, they would smear the sap on the branches of the tree. And when the bird would land, it would get stuck on it.
It's a way to catch the
bird. And catch the bird, the birdkill tree. Good. So that's an interesting sidelight on the tree also. Mm. Also, it's an understory tree. That means it can grow in partial shade. So if you have some big trees growing around it, the Gumbo Limbo can still survive because it does photosynthesis through the bark as well as its leaves. So when it does this peeling of the red bark, underneath it is a layer that most trees have called the cambium layer, which is the growth layer. But that tree can do photosynthesis through its trunk.
Right.
So there's another strategy for survival.
Very clever.
And also what they were used for on farms and other places is they will take root very easily. So they would cut off branches of a Gumbo Limbo and put it in a line to make a fence. In 3 or 4 years, you have a fence because they keep growing. You know, you don't even have to do anything to them. You just cut the branch, stick it in the ground, takes root.
Wow.
So that's another tree that was growing on these islands in Belize. And they grow on all of the Caribbean islands. So if you go to Trinidad, maybe you'll see it also.
I will have to see.
Yeah.
Now I
or
have
Tobago.
To go.
Okay. So the next, let's see, is there another tree I want to look up? Well, we'll talk about a critter. Oh, yeah, the next tree I want to talk about was the palm tree.
Right.
Everybody loves palm trees.
Right.
They're graceful. They're beautiful. But when a hurricane comes along, they're one of the first trees to get knocked down. Even though they look so flexible, you know, they bend with the wind a little bit and their leaves sort of flow with the wind. But their roots are very shallow.
Okay.
So if you look at the picture I put on of the palm tree, you can see the roots are right at the surface. So if they want to plant a new palm tree, you know, it's easier just to take the whole tree with the ball, root ball, because the root ball is very small compared to the size of the tree. And that's all I'll say about the palm tree. There are many varieties.
Right.
There are date palms in other countries where we get dates from. In the Caribbean, they're mostly just palm trees. Hearts of palm.
Right.
You've heard about eating hearts of
yes.
palm. That's the tip top of the tree where it's growing from.
Right.
So
coconut palms.
And coconut palms.
Don't sit under a coconut palm. I was in
right.
Africa once in a playground with my son, and sitting under the tree and thinking, oh, this is so wonderful, clusters of coconuts, all of a sudden, boom, didn't hit me, fortunately. Lucky, but I never sat under a coconut palm after that.
That's yeah, certain, they the come, coconut.
Because they're very tall.
They're very tall. And when the they come off heavy. The tree with the outer husk, which we hardly ever see, and shell, they must weigh 10 pounds easily.
Yeah, very heavy, right?
Very heavy. But the new coconut will grow from that seed because you find them washed up on the beaches, I saw in Belize,
right,
where
right.
a shoot's coming you right out sprout. Of the sprouting right, right out of the coconut.
Yeah.
So that's another interesting tree, the palm tree. I'm going to talk about some of the critters that we saw. Remember in my first show, I mentioned my neighbor, the iguanas.
Yes.
They were living on the roof and the ospreys on the other side. I didn't put up any pictures of those because everybody knows what iguana looks like anyhow. And ospreys by now, because ospreys are becoming more and more numerous. But I'm going to talk about some other things now. Washed up on the beaches, first of all, was something terrible in Belize. Plastic.
Oh.
Plastic, plastic, plastic. Plastic takes years and years to break down. So every day there were guys working for this resort who would rake up the beaches.
Mm.
Not only were they raking up the plastic, but the seagrasses continually die off and new shoots grow. And the dead seagrasses wash up on the beaches.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to have a nice clean beach for people to sit on, every morning they would rake the beach.
Right. And the plastic is washing in?
The plastic is washing in from other places. And it's terrible because the plastic is all over the world, all over the ocean. Mm-hmm. There's a gyre, which means like a whirlpool, of plastic that's about a mile wide in the Pacific Ocean.
Mm.
Because, you know, they fall off ships. We've been dumping garbage for years in the ocean, and this plastic is still there.
In Africa, too, you drive around, in West Africa anyway, you drive around and you see black plastic bags on the side of the road everywhere.
It's terrible, yeah. So anyhow, so the beaches in Belize, while they're really pretty, they have to clean them every morning to get up the plastic. So that was kind of an annoying thing. Okay, then we saw two very interesting things. One, it was a weed that washes up on the beach in clumps about the size of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called sargasso weed.
Oh, okay.
Now, sargasso, we've heard of sargasso.
The sargasso seed.
Everybody knows
right?
about the sargasso seed, which is off the Bahamas somewhere.
Right.
In the Pacific, which is this big, maybe mile in circumference, thicket of the sargasso seeds, weeds growing in the ocean. And they are a great place for critters to hide, baby fish. And there's a sargasso fish, which I didn't get a picture of, that looks exactly like the weeds. If you don't know that fish is there, you can't see it. And we have that in our museum in Ocean Life.
Right.
There's an exhibit on the sargasso, and you have to really look to see that fish. But I didn't see any of those fishes in Belize, but the sargasso weed washed up on the beaches. So what's interesting about them is they have little floats on them, so they don't sink.
Right.
And they drift around all over the ocean, and in some places they're much thicker. But they're an interesting plant to see on the beaches because they come from the Sargasso Sea. And they drift around and they just get washed up on the beach.
Now, we have seaweeds like that up here.
Right.
Because with those little, we used to snap those little air pockets.
The little float bladders.
Yeah.
That's similar to what Mickey showed us out at Montauk.
Right.
Right? The brown algae.
That's right.
Yeah. So Sargasso weed is an interesting weed. And we saw some of that on the beaches. And another thing we saw on the beaches was there would be pieces of wood, lumber, you know, that from buildings that had been blown down with the hurricane, or just small logs, or seeds. Mm. There was a big black seed about the size of a handball. You know the black handball that guys play? There was a seed that size. I think it's called a knicker bean, but I'm not quite sure. I don't know anything about those seeds. And on them were growing barnacles.
Wow. Yeah,
okay.
Interesting.
So I did a show at the beginning, which is about a year ago, on barnacles, which are crabs that have built a shell around themselves. They're lying on their back with their legs sticking up. And the barnacles we have around here, did you have barnacle bubbles
Absolutely.
On your boat?
Yes, you'd have to scrape them off
every year and repaint the bottom to keep them from growing there, but they grow there anyhow.
Right.
So they're called a fouling organism because they foul boat bottoms.
Right.
But they're really an interesting little critter because they make shells that are shape of a cone or a volcano.
Yes.
That's the shape.
That's right.
With three or four plates that they can close up because they have to be able to close up because they live in the intertidal zone, most of them. And when there's low tide and the water goes away, they have to be able to close up so they don't lose their body fluids and all that.
Right.
So there was a very interesting barnacle that was growing on some of the wharves and places on the beach and on some of the pilings. It's called the goose barnacle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, I call it the gooseneck barnacle because it looks like the head of a goose.
Interesting.
The shell is white.
Yeah.
And it's on a stem like the neck of a goose.
Huh.
Then the stem looks like, how would I describe it? It looks like, it doesn't have feathers, but it looks like an extension of, right. of something else.
And is the stem attached?
Yes. They attach themselves to something with the stem.
The stem is attached, and then the shell is at the end.
Then the animal is on top of this the stalk. I call it a stalk.
A stalk is probably correct.
So the head sort of looks like a goose.
Yeah.
So why is it called a goose barnacle, a gooseneck barnacle? I looked it up, and way back in the Middle Ages, it got its name because people didn't know where geese nested. Because the geese were wild, the wild geese, and they could never find the nest of the geese. And they thought that these were baby geese.
Oh.
How's that for a stretch?
Well, that's probably from Wikipedia.
No, I've seen it in other books, too. It's in Gene Kaplan's book.
Now what does that mean? People were so stupid that they thought it was a baby duck?
So they were called the barnacle geese.
Right.
Or
probably
geese
the same
barnacles.
Thing that you thought. It looked like the head of a goose.
A goose, right. So it's a good story, anyhow.
It's a very good story. Yeah.
You know, when I tell stories, people don't know whether it's true or not. But that's good. Keep them wondering. So we had these barnacle geese. And I wanted to get a picture of them feeding, because that's the interesting part of these geese. So I got some barnacles that were on one of these knicker beans, I think it was. And they closed up tight as soon as I took them out of the water. But at the stairway to our cottage or our cabana, there was a plastic pan full of water about 6 inches deep for you to wash your feet off, okay? So what I did is I dumped out the fresh water. I got some water from the ocean, which was about 20 feet away, and put fresh seawater in there, and I put them in there. And sure enough, they were very happy. They opened up, and they started feeding.
Mm.
And this is their feeding strategy is they have feet that have evolved from walking feet to feet that come out and grasp plankton.
Mm.
So if you look at the picture, you'll see 7 or 8 feet extending from the barnacle that look like almost feathery.
Interesting,
that are grabbing a plankton out of the water. So that's the way barnacle makes
very
its
good.
Living.
Yeah.
And when I did the show on barnacles up here, I spoke about, remember, our barnacles, after they're young juveniles, they settle down. They don't go anywhere. They're sessile. So they have a problem finding a mate because they can't go out looking for a mate.
Mm-hmm.
So in a barnacle patch where their barnacles all attached to the bottom, there are male and female barnacles.
Mm-hmm.
They can change their sex also, but the male barnacle has a penis that's bigger than any animal for its size because they have to reach out to a female and inseminate her.
Just over to the next barnacle?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And if the female is not that close,
right.
they have to really stretch out.
Wow.
So I thought that was an interesting
thing.
That
is interesting.
But it's a dangerous operation. Figure this male barnacle extending his penis out into the water column to inseminate. It's not internal insemination then because he's out in the in the water.
I wonder if it's traumatic insemination like with bed bugs.
I don't think so. I think the
there's
female's receptive.
There's a genital opening so that
yes,
he can penetrate.
She's receptive. I'm sure there are pheromones involved, but I don't know that much about them. But that's interesting. I don't know about the goose barnacles that I saw in Belize. They must do something similar. But they have this long neck to do it.
Yeah.
So it's easier
it's
for
easier,
them to do it.
Right.
Yeah. So remember that next time you see a barnacle. All right. Okay, so we spoke about the trees, and there was a beautiful starfish that was right off the shore.
I love starfish.
I couldn't resist picking it up.
How big?
And looking at it. It was probably 12 inches across.
Oh, nice.
And it's called the pincushion starfish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the starfish that we have around here, we don't call them starfish anymore. We call them sea stars because it's not really a fish.
Okay.
You know, a tuna fish is a fish.
Right.
And mackerel is a fish, but starfish is are called sea stars now.
All right.
Okay.
If you're in the Bronx, we call them starfish.
I know, but that's...
No, it's true.
That's
it's
the
not
old
a
days
fish.
In the Bronx.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So anyhow, these sea stars were about almost 12 inches across, and they're very rigid. You know, you remember your days of fishing? If you caught a starfish?
Sure.
The arms are very flexible.
That's right.
And the way that the starfish is around here eat is that they're the enemy of the oyster fishermen because they love oysters. What they'll do is they'll wrap their body around an oyster, and they have suction-powered feet.
Right.
Their tentacles are suction-powered. What they'll do is they'll attach to the oyster on either side of the oyster. The oyster is a bivalve. It has two shells, you know, like clams and all mm-hmm. that. And they'll apply pressure and slowly open up the oyster. Okay? And then what they'll do is, another good word, they'll estivate their stomach.
Right.
They'll take their stomach out of their body,
right.
put it into the oyster, and secrete digestive fluids and make it into chowder.
Mm.
And then suck it back in. That's the way they do it.
Delicious.
So, you're getting hungry.
I like oysters. So, yeah.
So, but the sea star that we saw, the pincushion, I'll have to look it up and see their lifestyle because they were pretty rigid. I don't think they could do that.
Probably not. Yeah.
Maybe they could estivate their stomach without wrapping around.
They're also bulky, right? They're not flat. Our sea stars here are flat.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful color.
They're beautiful.
It's this beautiful orange sepa color.
Right, right.
Very beautiful. And if you pick them up, of course, they retract their 2 feet right away. They get a little nervous. But if you put them back in the water, the 2 feet come out, and they'll actually walk on your hand
mm-hmm.
if you're very quiet and still. So that was another interesting critter that was on the beaches. Okay.
We could do a whole show on how these kinds of animals reproduce and how
yes,
they feed.
Yes, we should do that.
It's really
these
interesting.
These invertebrates have...
Well, let's figure that out.
Great, great strategies for survival and reproduction.
Yeah.
Yes, that's why I love that book by Kaplan, The Sensuous Seas.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Seas.
Yeah.
It has great stories in it. Okay, I'm going to talk about another bird that we saw. We saw some... okay, we have 1 minute left, so it's time for one bird.
Okay.
We saw some little blue herons
mm-hmm.
Foraging on the beach. Pelicans, which are great divers, they look, when they walk, they look so clumsy like
right.
penguins, but they are divers, beautiful flyers. They fly just at the water top. And then when they want to fish, they have to climb altitude and they'll dive headfirst into
right.
the water. It's a crazy lifestyle. I imagine they get a lot of headaches, but, you know, diving into water headfirst.
Right.
But that's their lifestyle. They were beautiful. And then there's the frigate bird. You know about the frigate bird?
I've heard of it.
The frigate bird is this absolutely beautiful flyer. It looks like a sailplane with slim wings, and it could go for miles without flapping its wings.
Yes.
The reason it's called a frigate bird, the other name of it is the man-o-war bird, okay? Because they're pirates.
Ah.
Okay? So if there's, let's say there's, we had this osprey family where their mom and pop would go fishing and pick up a fish. Well, the frigate bird would harass the osprey if it caught a fish. And harass it so much that the osprey would drop the fish
mm-hmm.
and the frigate bird would catch it in midair and go feed its kids.
Right, right.
So it's really a pirate.
Right. Other birds do that too. Eagles do that too. Yeah.
But the frigate bird, that's its lifestyle.
Right, yeah.
Okay? So that's why it was called a frigate, which was a warship in
right.
the British Navy,
right.
a frigate. And we still call some of our ships in the Navy frigates.
Frigates, yes, that's right.
And also a man of war, which was
right.
a battleship.
Yes.
That's how they got their name.
Right.
Man of war bird. So, but they're so beautiful. I watch them flying.
Mm.
Every afternoon, they would come and fly over the beaches like a squadron of them.
Mm.
And they were fantastic to see. In the morning, the ospreys would fly and go out fishing.
Right.
In the afternoons, the pelicans would come and do their diving. And the frigate bird would soar around. They look so beautiful.
It sounds like you had a wonderful time.
It was great.
You
Even
really
though,
learned a lot and did a lot of wonderful things.
It wasn't a sitting on the beach vacation,
not at
as
all.
You can hear.
No.
But I love these kind of vacations, and my partner Janet, she loves it too, so it makes it great. So we had a very nice time, and just to sum it up, there's so much to talk about the tropics.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and we were really in the tropics because.
Yes.
You know, I said that our latitude was 17 degrees north of the equator, and anywhere between the equator and the Tropic of Cancer is the tropics.
Right.
And the Tropic of Cancer in the northern latitude, I think it goes through southern Mexico, maybe Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the tropics.
Right.
Like Florida is in the subtropics, because subtropics... you can still get freezing weather.
Mm-hmm.
And we know sometimes they get freezing
right,
weather in Florida.
Do.
The oranges get frozen and all that stuff. So further south is the tropic zone. And we were in the real tropics. near the equator.
Right.
So I think, and all the Caribbean islands are in the tropics.
Right.
They all are.
I'm trying to remember where exactly the equator runs through.
Like. It goes through Ecuador,
okay.
Which means equal or equator.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And in Africa, it's also through, it's equatorial Africa.
Right.
Is it the Congo there? I don't really know.
It's Central Africa.
Africa. Yeah. So anyhow, this is the wrap-up for the show. And Jack's going to key up the music in a minute. And remember now that all these great pictures are on the site now. Just click on where it says click here for more photos. And we'll be back with a new show.
All right.
And we won't tell you what it is, but it's in the future. And we're going to do one on Everglades. I'll tell you that. And
right. one on the evolution of sight.
Of sight.
And certainly about how starfish and barnacles reproduce. I'm interested.
Right. Maybe we make a movie of that.
That would be good. Thank you for all the information on Belize. That's been wonderful.
So
really interesting.
It's been fun when Carol and I had this discussion. It makes it really nice for both of us. So we're signing off the air now, and take care. Music for dancing.
Music for learning. Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.